My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who will guide us to Destination Unlimited. We are living at a time when the lives of almost everyone have been greatly disrupted. Confronted by a deadly pandemic, the resultant economic upheaval, and a hard and mass reawakening to the evils of institutional and individual racism, many are processing grief, anger, and especially fear. How may we reawaken to a consciousness of understanding, compassion, healing, and love? Are there spiritual tools that we may use to restore balance and peace? My guest this week on Destination Unlimited, Ramananda John Welshans, says that a regular practice of vipassana, mindfulness meditation, will help us to ground, center, and balance. Ramananda John E. Welshans is a highly respected contemporary spiritual teacher who weaves together the mystical and contemplative branches of the world's great wisdom traditions. He lectures and leads meditation workshops and retreats across North America and is one of the most respected authorities on how to use life's inevitable difficulties as the steps on our path of spiritual awakening. He's been closely affiliated with spiritual luminaries Ram Dass and Stephen Levine and trained with Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. He's been practicing various forms of meditation and yoga for more than 50 years and has traveled and studied extensively in India, spending time in the ashrams of Neem Karoli Baba and Meher Baba. He's the author of 3 critically acclaimed books, One Soul, One Love, One Heart, Awakening from Grief, and When Prayers Aren't Answered, all published by New World Library. His website is onesoulonelove.com, and he joins us to share his path, his wisdom, and experience. Please join me in welcoming to Destination Unlimited, Ramananda John Welshans. Good evening, John.
Good evening, Victor. How nice to be with you. Thank you so much.
And how lovely to have you with me. We had the pleasure of meeting at our dear mutual friend Ariel Ford's birthday celebration in San Diego a couple of years back and have since become friends. And I've also been attending your weekly Zoom meditation sessions for the Van Vleck House in New Jersey and find them thoroughly enjoying. And we'll share that information later in the show with our listeners. So, John, from our listeners meeting you for the first time, please share your path and how it led to your spiritual journey.
Wow. Well, that's a long story, which I will endeavor to encapsulate a bit. My life began in 1950 in Newark, New Jersey. My father was a successful entrepreneurial businessman, and we had what I would say was a relatively privileged life. I contracted polio when I was 3 years old and nearly died. And when my parents were told about my condition, the doctors informed them that it was a 99% chance that I would die. And if I didn't die, a 95% chance that I would spend my life in an iron lung. Now, a lot of people who are living, who are listening, may not know what an iron lung was. It was basically a big respirator that you just laid on your back in this big cylinder that would breathe for you, because polio, the form that I had, was the kind that destroyed the muscles and nerves that control breathing. My father said to the doctors, "What can we do?" They said, "There's nothing we can do." Finally, one of the doctors said, "Well, you can pray." So my father, who was, as I said, a very successful entrepreneurial businessman, called all of his business associates, all of his family members and friends, said, "This is happening to our son. Will you please pray for him in whatever tradition you practice?" And within a couple of days, he had over 200 people who had committed to praying. One night he had a vision of Jesus standing next to my bed in the hospital. And my father saw that he was kind of in that state of just about falling asleep. He woke up. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. He said, "That's got to be good." He ran in and woke my mother up, and he said, "Don't worry, John is going to be okay." And 20 minutes later, at 2:20 a.m., there was a phone call from the hospital. The head nurse on the ward where I was saying, "Mr. Welshans, there has been a miracle. Your son is awake. His fever has broken, and he's demanding pancakes." And I had been basically in a coma for about 3 weeks. So that made an impression on me. Even though I was 3 years old, it certainly became part of the family lore and my life story. And then my life took an interesting twist when I was about 11. My parents resumed some behavior that they had been engaged in before I was born, which was that they were both very serious alcoholics. And they had gotten sober right after I was born. And then my father took a job where he was traveling a lot. And when he was away, started drinking again. And then my mother started drinking again. And our house went from a beautiful, loving home to an absolute hell realm, basically in the blink of an eye. And there's another interesting side story, which is that my parents were married by Norman Vincent Peale.
Oh.
In 1944 in New York City. And so my father was a big proponent of Norman's book, The Power of Positive Thinking. He was also very enamored of Emmett Fox's teaching because he'd been exposed to that through Alcoholics Anonymous. Emmett was very popular with AA people. And so I had that counterbalancing the fact that my parents just suddenly overnight seemed to go insane. And my father, who was one of the nicest people on earth when he was sober, was one of the most demonic people you'd ever want to meet when he was drinking. So I just spent much of my life sobbing. And finally, I remember one day saying to myself, I didn't realize this until many years later, but I basically made a choice inwardly that if I was going to survive, I had to stop feeling. And I became very numb. And throughout my teenage years, I was numb and I became kind of a disgruntled, angry hippie. Then when I was 18, my father got sober, my mother died, and shortly after my mother died, I heard the name of Meher Baba, great Indian spiritual master. And immediately after hearing his name for the first time, I had some extraordinary transcendent mystical experiences that were really the change that was the turning point in my life, really. And I began studying Meher Baba's teachings and couple of years later encountered Ram Dass for the first time and basically began to embark on the path of exploring yoga and meditation and Buddhism and Hinduism, primarily Taoism to some extent. When I went to college, I wound up becoming a religion major because it was the only thing I was really interested in at that point, that I would just really yearning to understand the meaning of life and the purpose of life. And I think my background in shifting back and forth from privilege to nearly dying to privilege to seeing my parents being absolutely miserable in spite of their privilege really caused me to look very deeply at what life was about. And that's continued to this day.
We're going to touch upon your teaching and your learning, rather, from Ram Dass and Stephen Levine and others a little bit later in the show. But right now, you shared with me actually recently that after your father's passing, you were asked by your sisters to take on the responsibility of his business for the family. As someone whose life was dedicated to spiritual pursuit, what was it like to embrace the not-so-often spiritual world of business?
Well, it was really interesting, Victor. And for a number of years, I hated it. And then somebody said to me, one of my dear friends, who we shared a connection with Neem Karoli Baba, Ram Dass's guru, and this friend of mine said to me once that Neem Karoli Baba had said to him, when he was going through a very difficult period of his life, Neem Karoli Baba had communicated to him inwardly, he said the following. He said, before you can leave it, you have to learn to love it.
Mm.
And I couldn't seem, all I ever wanted to do was sell the family business, and I couldn't seem to make it happen. And then I heard that teaching from Neem Karoli Baba, before you can leave it, you have to learn to love it, which I think is one of the most significant things I've ever heard.
Absolutely. And that was the philosophy you took with you.
Yeah, yeah. And that was, I had to change my whole attitude toward it and learn how to be grateful and actually love this business that my father had left to us.
His name is Ramananda John Welshans. We're talking about the path that he's taken and mindfulness meditation to deal with the things that we're experiencing in our world at this time and into the future. We'll be back with more of John after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
I was in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean when it happened. There was a sudden jolt and our submarine crashed on the seafloor. We were in total darkness.
That's Dr. Dejana Figueroa, a marine biologist and STEM teacher, talking about a deep sea dive she'll never forget.
It's funny. When I was a kid, I was afraid of the ocean. And there I was, 2 miles below the surface. But as a scientist, you prepare for that. Using our training and a little creativity, we fixed the sub and finished our experiments. The dive was just too important. Every dive gives us glimpses at things few people ever get to see. Glowing creatures, fiery undersea volcanoes. When we got back to the surface, I kissed the ground and called my mom, of course. But you know what? I wouldn't trade that dive for anything.
Dr. Figueroa uses her passion for STEM to discover new things and make the world a better place. She can STEM, so can you. Check out She Can STEM for more stories and inspiration. A message from the Ad Council.
During these times of worry, fear, and uncertainty, a calming and soothing voice may help you relax, clear your mind, and help you sleep. This is Victor the Voice Furman, and for the first time, I'm offering my voice for your well-being. I will craft a personal guided meditation to suit your needs. My fees are very reasonable, and I can provide your personalized guided meditation quickly. For more information, please send an email to voice@victorthevoice.com. That's voice@victorthevoice.com. Blessings, my friend. On Destination Unlimited, my guest this week, my dear friend Ramananda John Welshans. We're talking about mindfulness meditation and how we can use that today in this world of confusion and fear and frustration. John, you had the blessing, as we had mentioned in the first segment, of studying with two great teachers, Ram Dass and Stephen Levine. How did those experiences shape you and your work?
Oh, well, you know, I have often said that if there's anything that's good about me, it's because of Ram Dass. And we could put Stephen Levine in that category too. I think that their influence, which started with Ram Dass's, and then Ram Dass introduced me to Stephen, who was in those days, you know, probably Ram Dass's best friend. I'm finding it difficult to find the words. You know, my Ram Dass just died back in this past December of 2019, at the age of 88. And I sat in meditation for several days after that, and all our mutual friends kept calling me or writing to me and saying, what are you feeling? And I kept thinking, well, I'm supposed to be feeling grief. And there was grief, but basically it was just gratitude. It was gratitude for the opportunity to spend those years with him, 47 years I knew him. And it was the opportunity to be with someone who was the real deal. You know, Ram Dass was not a perfect human being, but he was extraordinary in his ability to be honest and to be self-revealing. He used to say things like, you know, I like to publish all of my secrets because I don't want some muckraker coming along and exposing me. Like, I'll just tell the world who I am. And all of his various foibles over the years. And I never saw him take advantage of another human being. I never saw any hint that he was in it for money. I always saw someone who was completely dedicated to service, serving his fellow human beings, to doing what he could do to bring enlightenment to the world. And, you know, I mean, he would take breaks now and then to sort of renew and recharge. But basically, when he was on duty, so to speak, he was doing it fully. And the same thing was true of Stephen Levine. Stephen had started as a meditation teacher, and Ram Dass actually had suggested to both of us separately. I didn't know Stephen at the time, but Ram Dass had said to both of us we should study with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Because he was saying, Ram Dass was saying in the early 70s, that working with people who were dying and people who were grieving was the highest spiritual practice he had ever come upon. And I was impressed by that because I thought, you know, he's come upon a lot of high spiritual practices, and that's the highest. Fascinating. I didn't quite get it. But it turned out that Stephen and I wound up at the same workshop in Berkeley, California in March of 1976. Stephen met Elizabeth, and she immediately invited him to start teaching meditation at her dying retreats. And he worked with her for a number of years and then went out on his own. And he and Ram Dass created something called the Dying Project. So that wasn't by any means the entirety of our work, but it was a big chunk of it for many years. The work with figuring out how to apply the spiritual principles and practices that had so inspired us to the experience of grieving and to the experience of preparing to leave one's own body. And I would have to say that I got what Ram Dass was saying. I got that it is indeed the highest spiritual practice I've ever come upon.
And it was the major theme in your book, Awakening from Grief, Finding the Way Back to Joy. What prompted you to write that?
Well, interestingly enough, that was the first book. And it had been the focus of my work for so many years. And actually, it was Stephen and Andrea who encouraged me to write it. And it started with a couple of magazine articles. And I sent them to Stephen and Andrea. And they called me up and they said, well, this is the beginning of your book. And I said, what book? And they said, well, you're going to write a book. I said, I am. And that wound up being the beginning of the book. And really, what I was doing was two things. Primarily, Stephen had written a wonderful book called Who Dies, which had been like my Bible. for a number of years. And every time somebody would ask me, what's the one book I should read about grief? I would say, Who Dies? And then I found that if people didn't have a background in Eastern thought, the book kind of confused them. And they would come back to me and say, I don't really understand that book. So I asked Stephen how he would feel if I endeavored to write a book that was a Who Dies for the masses, you know, a more accessible book that wasn't so rooted in Eastern thought, although it's still rooted in Eastern thought, but that wasn't quite as obvious when I wrote Awakening from Grief. So that was really how it started. And what I wanted to do ultimately was to not talk about grief, but to allow people to experience their own grief through reading it, in the sense that I didn't want it to be an academic exercise. I wanted it to be a heart-opening exercise. And it seems to have worked that way for many, many people. You know, it still sells quite well and came out originally 20 years ago. And that's what people tell me, that it really touches their hearts. And I have Stephen and Andrea to thank for that, and Ram Dass and a variety of other people. But yeah, that's where it came from.
And we're going to talk more about grief and the current situation a little bit later, but I wanted to touch on this. Your path led you to both the ashrams of Neem Karoli Baba and Meher Baba. What did you learn from your trip to India and these ashrams?
Well, interestingly, given the subject we're just on, I think the first trip, which was in 1973, and I wound up going to Meher Baba's ashram because Neem Karoli Baba had just died. I met Ram Dass in May of 73 and immediately made plans to go to India in December of 73, and Neem Karoli Baba died in September, so I missed him by 3 months. So I went to Meher Baba's ashram with some dear friends of mine from college. I think the very first thing that struck me in India was the evident presence of death. Fascinating. You know, we got to Mumbai Airport, then it was known as Bombay, and got through customs, went out and got in a taxi cab, and were driving to the place we were going to stay for a day in Mumbai, and there was a truck in front of us. And it kept stopping, and it was just at dawn, and we've been flying for 24 hours. We're all exhausted and groggy and bleary-eyed, and this truck kept stopping, and people were getting out and doing things. And finally, I said to the driver of the taxi, "What is that truck doing?" And he said, "Oh, that is truck that picks up dead bodies, sir." Mm. And I said, "Dead bodies?" He said, "Yes. You know, people die on street overnight, and truck picks up." And that was my welcome to India. And then, for anyone who's ever been to India, you know, we drove in this absolutely psychotic manner through the streets of Mumbai in death-defying ways that only, you know, people used to say that the driving in Rome was crazy. The driving in India was way crazier. And I was sitting there in the taxi. Now I'm thinking, after observing this truck, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, this is really something. I'm only 22 years old. I've flown halfway around the world. I've spent my life savings to come to this crazy exotic country. And I'm going to die in a taxi cab accident. And no one will know what ever happened to me. And that really became the theme. And then I wound up getting quite sick. And when I was staying with Meher Baba's devotees in near his ashram, I kept sort of going back and forth from being on what I thought might be my deathbed to getting up and going to the ashram for the afternoon, then coming back and being too sick to go the next day. And it was a very fascinating affirmation that ultimately facing our own mortality is one of the most powerful spiritual things we can do. It's an extraordinary spiritual practice. And I started to think how fascinating that we live in a culture where we grow up being told not to think about death, not to talk about it, and when we're grieving, to pretend we're not grieving, because we're afraid that these experiences are too difficult for human beings to deal with. And I grew up feeling like, you know, death is something that's so bad, obviously the big people won't even talk about it. That was terrifying. And to realize that just surrendering to this ultimate reality, that we are mortal, we're all going to die, and we don't know when or how, that really became the transformation in my life that was, the next big step.
His name is Ramananda John Welshans. John, please tell our listeners where they can find out more about you, your books, and all of your wonderful work.
Oh, thank you, Victor. My website is onesoulonelove.com, all spelled out, onesoulonelove.com. I'm on Facebook. You're invited to send me a friend request or just sign up on my professional page on Facebook. And I love to communicate with people, so you know, I'm happy you can send me an email through the website or on Facebook or whatever you like.
And we'll be back with more of John and mindfulness at this time of COVID-19 and the upheaval we're seeing in our world after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
This is OTRFM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
Right now, we all feel a little disconnected. For seniors living alone, the isolation can be overwhelming. Connect with an older loved one and have the conversation of a lifetime at StoryCorpsConnect.org/AARP. A message from AARP, StoryCorps, and the Ad Council.
So I'm a cat, and I just moved in with this new human, and she's got this little toy she's always playing with all day long. Tap, 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 bloop, bloop. She can't put it down. There it is. Oh, and get this. She even talks to it. Last week, she asked it for Chinese. And guess what? Egg rolls showed up. Like magic. Humans have cool toys.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
They say singing can help you remember things. So here's some tips for parents out there during these tough times.
Number one.
Make sure your kids wash their hands for 20 seconds after they've coughed or sneezed or been outside.
Two.
Virtual playdates, social and physical distancing can help save lives.
Three.
Tell them they're safe and show your love and pride. Yes, we'll get through this together.
Find out more at coronavirus.gov. A message from the CDC and the Ad Council.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week is my dear friend Ramananda John Welshans. John, before we talk about grief again and the current grief situation, what does your spiritual name Ramananda mean for those not familiar with it?
Oh, it means bliss of God. Ram is one of the incarnations of God in the Hindu pantheon, and Ananda means bliss, so bliss of God.
And who gave you that wonderful name?
It was actually Ram Dass in a dream. And it was one of those dreams that wasn't really a dream. And it's a kind of a long story, but it actually was right before, those of you who know Ram Dass know that he had a major stroke in 1997. And I had always kind of wanted a spiritual name, but I wasn't quite sure how you got one. I thought maybe the guru would just tell you what your name was, which was the case in Ram Dass's, you know, when his guru just started calling him Ram Dass. So, but no one ever did. And then one night I had this dream in which Ram Dass essentially gave me the name Ramananda. He said Swami Ramananda. I thought, well, I can't call myself a Swami. That's too much. But Ramananda, and I said, is that my name? And he said, if you want it. So I said, great. And then the dream had other facets to it. But when I woke up about 4:30 in the morning, I woke up my wife and I said, I just had the most extraordinary dream of Ram Dass, and I think something big is about to happen. And 2 days later, he had the stroke, which completely changed his life. And but that's where the name came from.
Wonderful. Thank you for sharing that. That's an amazing story. Yeah. We talked about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and your study with her and the concept of grief and grieving. Before all of this started, our current situation, grief was obviously a major part of our world. But what would Elizabeth Kubler-Ross have to share about the extent, the widespread extent of grief on all levels at this time?
There's a quote that I use sometimes in lectures from Elizabeth. Unfortunately, I don't have it at hand at the moment. But it basically says, I have never met one single human being whom, when you get right down to the nitty-gritty, doesn't have as their greatest desire and greatest need love. And I think that we have been moving so quickly in this culture prior to the pandemic and to having to shelter in place and so on, that a lot of people have recognized that actually having the time off, aside from the obvious financial and economic stresses and, you know, other pressures and the fears and worries, but basically we've gotten this opportunity, many of us, to spend more time with our families and our loved ones and start to realize that the pace we've been living at has been more than perhaps than the human being was designed to sustain. And that we've been living with a kind of grief in this culture because of our disconnection from each other, despite the fact that we're all connected technologically, but that the technology has been allowing us to lose heart-to-heart and eye-to-eye and hand-to-hand connection. And that maybe when we realize that, you know, we've been asked not to touch and not to hug and things like that, how much we need that as a species, how much we yearn for connection and love and presence. So I think that is really, you know, I think Elizabeth would look at our culture and remind us of the many ways that we grieve, not just about the loss of our own life or the loss of loved ones, but that we've been grieving the loss of quality of life, in a sense, because everybody's been living at such a pace and under such pressure to perform and produce and be highly scheduled and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that maybe this has given us a few moments to stop and recognize that we've been grieving.
Of course, your point taken, the extent of loss at this time, transcends the loss of loved ones. We face loss of jobs and income, loss of a sense of security, loss of physical safety, loss of faith, and threats to our way of life as we know it. What would you share at this time?
Well, it's a statement or a teaching that we have been taught not to want to listen to. So sometimes it can seem a little harsh because, you know, basically Americans haven't wanted to hear it. But the truth of the matter is that nothing is ever guaranteed. In this physical universe, you know, or as they say, the guarantees are that we'll pay taxes and we'll die. Beyond that, the only other guarantee is that everything is going to change. And sometimes it changes in a way we like, and sometimes it changes in a way we don't like. But, you know, I think one of the things that really drew me to Buddha's teachings, dating back several decades now, you know, I'm sort of like Ram Dass, who used to say, I'm a Jewish Hindu who loves Buddha and Christ. You know, I think that the teachings of Buddha shared was, number one, that life involves suffering. And it wasn't that he was saying life sucks and then you die. You know, he was saying that if you don't acknowledge that there's suffering in life, you can't be happy. Because every time something changes in a way you don't want it to, or won't change in the way you want it to, you're going to suffer. So if you realize that change is inherent in the physical universe, then perhaps you're on the path to suffering less because it's just the way it is. Now, there are things that have happened that we might say maybe weren't necessary, but in a greater perspective or greater, higher perception of things, maybe all this had to happen to get our attention. Maybe it had to be this bad to get our attention, to realize that we can't just do what, you know, a lot of people are calling these days spiritual bypassing. In other words, the idea that everything's beautiful and if it isn't, don't pay attention to it.
Yeah.
Buddha was asking us to pay attention to everything, the good and the bad, the things we love and the things we don't like, and to realize that it's really in our mind's reaction to things that we suffer rather than in the evolution of things. And you and I, you know, have discussed how much this time has been a blessing. I just got off a call with another friend of mine who was saying how he has enjoyed just having the time to be with his wife. And I've enjoyed having the time to be with my wife. And it's been just beautiful, but it's also been a little hair-raising because, you know, our income dropped to zero and we were rightly concerned about that, but also realizing that it wasn't going to do any good to be paralyzed by fear and that we needed to just take the fear and turn it into love.
Is it possible to embrace and own our grief and pain at the same time that we enjoy and have peace in our lives?
I don't see why not. I mean, you know, the mind might say, gee, I don't see how that works. But, you know, there's an interesting thing that happens. I've been noticing that every morning I have woken up, and this spring has been a very nice spring here in New Jersey for the most part. So I wake up in the morning and I think, oh, God, what a beautiful morning. What a beautiful sunrise. And I just go into this state of ecstasy. And then I remember, oh, yeah, but there's a pandemic going on and the whole world seems to be falling apart. But then I look at the sun and I look at the sky and I was watching the trees blossoming over the course of the spring. And recently I've been reading a book of poetry by Thich Nhat Hanh. And most of the poems in it were written at the height of the Vietnam War. And he was a Vietnamese Buddhist monk who who lived through the horrors of the Vietnam War and yet was able each day, and wrote poetry about this, he was able each day to experience the beauties of nature, the exquisite songs of birds singing, and the beauty of the sun rising and the sun setting while there's a war going on around him. And I think that's a really interesting and important ability to cultivate, because we live in a culture that makes things much more simple in a way that isn't so good. In other words, we tend to think we're either happy or we're not happy. And one of the interesting aspects of the experience of grief is when you really start to learn that you can be happy, you can appreciate nature, you can appreciate a good joke and something that's funny and laugh, even at the same time as you're grieving.
Absolutely. And having lost my job back in March because of the current situation, I've had the beautiful luxury, and it was a luxury up until recently, of being able to sit outside every morning with the sun rising and the beautiful birds and species of birds I haven't seen in years in our area here, mm-hmm. including blue jays and cardinals and robins and beautiful turtle doves in our little urban garden over here, and the squirrels who I feed and the birds who I feed. So yeah, that ability to have that communion with nature and appreciate life as it is with everything going on. My guest, Ramananda John Welshans, will be back with more of John after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
The student asks the teacher, "How do I experience transformation?" The teacher replies, "When the student is ready to receive deeper answers, the student then asks, 'How do I know what deeper questions to ask?' And the teacher replies, 'When the student decides to commit to a practice inviting transformation, level 2 questions will be revealed.'" Hi, I'm Tomas Garza, and as a teacher and host, I'm inviting listeners to enroll in the Mastery of Transformation by joining me on Decide to Transform, your bridge to level 2 answers, Tuesdays, 1 p.m. Eastern, on Om Times Radio.
Here's today's STEM tip. Don't throw out that old plastic bottle. Repurpose it by turning it into an awesome terrarium. Just fill it with sand, pebbles, soil, and your favorite plant. It'll grow sealed right in its own ecosystem. Learn more at She Can STEM. A message from the Ad Council.
A social distancing tip.
Keeping your distance from others is important in slowing the spread of coronavirus. So here are some fun things to do alone. Read a book. Take a walk. Unpack your suitcase from that trip you took last September. Paint a self-portrait. Catch up on a TV series. Do a puzzle. Remember, we should all stay home to lower the risk for everyone. For more info, visit coronavirus.gov.
Let's all do our part, because we're all hashtag alone together. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week, my dear friend, Ramananda John Welshans. John, your second book was called When Prayers Aren't Answered. What inspired you to write it?
Well, basically an extension of what we were talking about earlier and how I originally wrote Awakening from Grief, which was basically to answer, what do I do when I have a heartbreaking, life-shattering loss? And then I noticed that for many people, what comes up after the initial phase are the questions of, like, is there a God? If there is a God, how does he allow these terrible things to happen? He, she, or it, we should say. And so I wanted to write a book that answered those questions. And I realized that the most popular book on that subject was When Bad Things Happen to Good People by Rabbi Kushner.
Yes.
And when I read that book, I realized that he was writing primarily from the perspective of the Old Testament. So I thought, well, I'll write the same kind of a book from the perspective of Hinduism and Buddhism primarily. So those are the philosophies that underlie the reflections in When Prayers Aren't Answered.
What is the relationship between prayer and meditation?
Well, the easy answer to that is to say that prayer is talking to God and meditation is listening to God. Now, sometimes God is a difficult concept for some people, and I always say if it's uncomfortable, then substitute the word love or unconditional divine love or whatever, the highest form of love you can, that's beyond anything you can conceive of, basically. But that's basically it. I mean, I've met so many people who claim to be atheists who, when the chips are down, will pray, you know, and maybe it's just, well, I'm just trying to cover all bases just in case.
Absolutely.
I remember as a young man, when my parents started drinking, you know, we were a church-going family, and then my parents started drinking, and I became kind of agnostic. And then I went through a period where there was a major crisis happening, and I found myself praying, which I hadn't done in about 5 years when I was maybe 17 years old. And so, you know, it's something that I think we do almost instinctively. So whatever it means to everyone, you know, meditation is receiving, I think, either wisdom from God or our own inner wisdom. And prayer might be about asking to be able to receive that wisdom.
Some feel that unanswered prayer is an indication of either abandonment or punishment from the divine as they know the divine. How would you address this?
Well, I think that's an incorrect perception. I think that is rooted in a somewhat unrealistic concept of God, in which, you know, we might call it the anthropomorphic concept of God, which is that God is just a very big, complex human being and thinks the way we think and wants what we want and loves the way we love. I think it's a whole different thing, Victor, you know, really. I think it's something that is really beyond comprehension. Like Stephen Levine used to say that he was perfectly content to talk about God because he had no idea what it meant. And to me, it is the light that is at the heart of this universe, that created this universe and sustains this universe. And that light manifests as love, but a very profound kind of love. Like Meher Baba used to talk about the magnetism, the force of gravity that keeps the planets in their orbits as a form of love. I mean, you know, love is like something much greater than our puppy love or romantic love when, you know, that we were introduced to as teenagers. So the idea that that love would abandon us is inconceivable. It may not give us what we want, but it generally gives us what we need if we listen and just allow ourselves to accept what the universe puts on our plate. And in that way, I looked at this pandemic not as abandonment, but perhaps as something we needed to experience. And what good could come out of it? You know, it's an interesting thing. Most human beings go through difficult times. And we're going through difficult times individually and as a collective right now. Most human beings, when they look back on the difficult times, will say something like, "That was absolutely horrible. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. I never want to go through it again. But boy, did I grow through that experience or that period of my life. And that really was another thing that I wanted to capture in When Prayers Aren't Answered, the recognition that the difficult things that happen to us in life are often the things that show us our true greatness, because we often endure things that, you know, if someone had told us before they happened, this is what you're going to go through, we would say, I couldn't endure that. I couldn't bear that. I couldn't do that. And yet, when we're in the middle of it, we find a way.
Your last book, One Soul, One Love, One Heart, you say that the path to happiness is the path of love. Is love the answer to everything?
I think so. But, you know, I'm kind of a nut that way. So.
Well, you're in good company because I feel the same way.
I mean, I honestly feel that there is scarcely any problem in human life that wouldn't be healed with more love. And that means, you know, when we're talking about racism, as you mentioned, you know, it's on everybody's mind these days. What is the problem with racism really is a lack of love, an inability to love someone who's different than you are. And, you know, the idea that, you know, we're arguing about whether or not to wear masks, for instance. Well, you know, my feeling about that is that we have been asked to wear masks to protect each other. It's an expression of love. It's not an expression of fear. It's an expression of the fact that, you know, I could have been exposed to the virus without knowing it. I might not have symptoms, and I might pass it on to you. And if we wear masks and stay 6 feet apart, we will eliminate much of that possibility. So I love you, and I don't want to do that to you. So what's the problem with wearing a mask? That would be an act of love.
Which leads to the question, how may we love one another when many do things that we consider beyond loving or even liking?
Well, you know, that's a big topic, Victor. And I think that the, you know, Neem Karoli Baba used to constantly say, can't you see it's all perfect? And of course, people would say, no, I don't see it's perfect. How could it be perfect? A pandemic is perfect. You know, the economy shutting down is perfect. My children not being in school. How could this be perfect? And he keeps saying it's all perfect. Well, it started to occur to me that from the perspective of the universe, of that one light that creates and sustains the entire universe, at that level, I don't think God has opinions. If we see that as God, that you have to have an opinion to determine that something isn't perfect. If there are no opinions, then of course it's all perfect. It's unfolding the way it has to. We live in the world of form, the world of duality. We have good and bad, light and dark, happiness and sadness. That's the world we live in. But beyond all that, there is this perfection. Now, how that plays itself out is that in the world of duality, part of the perfection is that when I see someone do something cruel to another human being or say something cruel, my heart hurts. And when my heart hurts, I want to do something to make the world a better place. Now, if I see someone punch a fellow human being in the nose, and my answer to that is to go punch the perpetrator in the nose, you know, we might have gotten some retribution, but we're not going to make the world a better place. So I think that loving everyone implies loving and understanding that loving and forgiving do not mean approving of bad behavior, and they don't mean that we're condoning bad behavior or allowing people to get away with it. You know, if someone lies, if someone cheats, if someone steals, if someone commits acts of violence, then, and we know that they do that, then it's incumbent upon us that if we're going to love everyone, we have to love the people who either have been victims of their mischief or could potentially be victims of their mischief. That would be loving everyone too. How do you protect everyone from the small group of people who do unkind, cruel, violent acts? So it's a much bigger thing. And you don't have to hate people to restrain them from doing evil things. You know, I mean, what good would that do? I used to teach meditation in prisons. And I learned to really love people who had done horrendous things and to see how they were struggling to love themselves.
And in the process of loving them, perhaps opening their hearts to themselves.
Exactly.
My wonderful guest, my dear friend, Ramananda John Welshans. John, one more time, please tell our listeners where they can find your website, your books, and all about your wonderful work.
The website is onesoulonelove.com, all spelled out, onesoulonelove.com. I participate a lot on Facebook. You're invited to send me a friend request or just sign up on my professional page. The three books, Awakening from Grief, When Prayers Aren't Answered, and One Soul, One Love, One Heart, are all available through normal booksellers on Amazon, on Barnes & Noble, and local bookstores can order them if they don't have them in stock. So I invite anyone who would like to get in touch, send me an email, or just sign up on Facebook, or however you'd like to stay in touch. I would be delighted.
John, my hands are pressed together in front of my heart, and I bow and I say namaste. Thank you so much.
Oh, Victor, thank you, and namaste to you and all your listeners.
And thank you for joining us on Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful week.